Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with financial journalist and editorial entrepreneur Rob Cox. Mr. Cox is the 2017 James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz, named for the founder of Ottaway Newspapers Incorporated, now the Dow Jones Local Media Group. And just to remind our listeners, WMC has interviewed each of the Ottaway Fellows, as well as James Ottaway Jr., since the inception of the program. This year, Ottaway Professor Cox will share ideas about journalism and the media with students, faculty, staff, and community members at public lectures and events, in addition to leading the Financial Journalism and the Business of Media seminar. Professor Cox will also deliver a public speech at New Paltz on Tuesday, April 4th at 7 p.m. in the Kuykendall Science Building Auditorium. He'll talk about the phenomenon of globalization through the story of his grandfather's electric carving knife. Professor Cox is also the global editor of Reuters Breaking Views, the financial commentary division of Thomson Reuters. He helped found that publication in 2000 and guided through its expansion into the United States in 2004 and its acquisition by Thomson Reuters in 2009. Professor Cox is a frequent contributor to CNBC, has written opinion pieces for The Wall Street Journal, BuzzFeed, Newsweek, USA Today, and other publications. A resident of Newtown, Connecticut, Cox also helped found Sandy Hook Promise, an organization dedicated to preventing gun violence that formed in the wake of the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Cox visited New Paltz during the fall 2015 semester to speak with psychology, journalism, and disaster mental health students about his career and his experience working with the group. We'll talk to Professor Rob Cox about all of this accomplishments and more, but first, welcome Professor Cox.
Pleasure to be here, Alan.
Well, it's delightful to have you here. It's a very impressive career. I like to start at the beginning with so many people, so maybe you could tell us a little bit about where you were born, how you were raised, who your parents were, and what they did.
Oh, right. Okay, well, that's easy. I was born in Boston, but moved to Newtown, Connecticut when I was a couple of years old. My dad was an English professor and a teacher, and so we moved. I guess he got a job in Reading, Connecticut, which is part of Fairfield County, and we moved there. My brother was born, and my parents were strong believers in public education, not least because my father then worked at a high school in Connecticut. My mother became a middle school professor, and they were always very involved, not just in their jobs and their lives, but in their communities. So my mother was very active in politics, and my dad was a big volunteer, and that was sort of something that through my life, you know, has guided me in many respects. They were also, you know, big readers. So I grew up reading not least the Danbury News Times, which was an Ottaway paper, if you can believe it, sort of full circle here, right? And I then delivered that paper. And so sort of that was my introduction to journalism, as it were. But I grew up in Connecticut and left and went to college at the University of Vermont. Never thought I would ever come back to Newtown, Connecticut. I did many years later, as you pointed out, and still maintain my home there, largely because the community was, in many respects, a fantastic place to raise children. And so that was the reason I came back. My kids were born when I was a foreign correspondent in Italy and in London, and it was great to bring them back to my folks. But those were my formative years, playing hockey, learning how to play football, and realizing I wasn't very good at it, and it was much better skating. And understanding a little bit what it's like to be in a community that is so dependent in some ways on places like New York City. So I'd spend all my free time when I was able and allowed going into the city. In fact, going into places like the New York Public Library and looking at all the newspapers that one could find, not just from around the world, but from places around the United States that I could only imagine ever going to. Now, of course, we get it all online, but I remember going to that reading room and thinking, gosh, it would be great to be a journalist.
You know, I have a three-year-old grandson now, just a truly remarkable part of my life. Never thought it would be, but it is. And, you know, I've been talking to Elizabeth Esty, your wonderful congresswoman, for years, and to Senator Murphy, too, on our Congressional Corner program. And it's extraordinary to me. It seems to me that the Newtown tragedy may be the worst thing I've ever come across. There have been many more people killed and buses ramming into people and killing more people, but The idea of these beautiful little children being wiped out, and I always get criticism for using terms like this, but being wiped out by a madman is almost more than I can personally handle. And I know it's had a tremendous impact on you.
Yeah, well, no, so as I mentioned, I moved back to Newtown about 15 years ago from London to raise my kids because I knew the school system. My parents were there, so there were the sort of synergies and all that kind of stuff. And I knew it would be a fantastic place. I still, you know, it certainly don't regret any of that. But, you know, being part of that community when the tragedy hit, or, you know, when the murders were committed, I should say, in 2012, I sort of felt like it was my, you know, my civic duty, as it were, to just do whatever I could to try to help out. And, you know, going back to your point, you mentioned Elizabeth Esty and Chris Murphy. What's quite interesting is I had not met them until that week. So, you know, they had come, I think it was about 4 or 5 days after the shootings, which occurred on a Friday. It might have been the Tuesday or so. We had a meeting of, you know, we were just pulling people together in the town to try to meet and say, what can we do to help? What can we do to help the community? What can we do to help those families that lost the most? And what can we do to warn, or, you know, while we have the global media in our, at our doorstep, you know, what can we do to try to prevent this from happening to another community? And it's quite interesting, on the second meeting we had, did at the Newtown Public Library, the Cornelius H. Booth Library on Main Street, which was clogged with hearses and satellite trucks and everything. It was just the most horrific scene you could imagine visiting upon a small town like Newtown. And Dick Blumenthal, who are senators in Connecticut, and Chris had not yet even been sworn in, because this was, you know, December 14th, 2012. So he had won the Senate seat, having been a congressman before, and had become a senator. And so this was defining for him. And I think you can see it in the work he's done over the past, you know, 4 years, 4+ years. He has been so connected to this tragedy in many ways, to find Chris Murphy's tenure thus far as a senator. And it certainly did for Elizabeth Esty, who is represents our district. I mean, she has been very focused on, and it's not just a gun question, it's on just the whole issue around gun violence. And, you know, and remember, she has cities as well as communities like Newtown that have daily occurrences of gun violence, not like the sort of once in a millennial visitation of evil that we witness in Newtown. So, you know, you mentioned them. They were at our first couple of meetings. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Chris was there for one of the children's funerals or wakes. Elizabeth, probably the same thing. And they popped in and they spoke to our group of people. This was before Sandy Hook Promise was a thing. It was really just a group of people, concerned citizens, and really talking about what we could do. And it was pretty chaotic, but they brought some order to it by just saying, look, you know, here's what you can do. Here's how you can help us. Here's how we can help you. You need to organize. You need to get numbers on your side. You need to focus on these kinds of issues. And they were right in many respects. But it was, yeah, as you say, Alan, I mean, you'd think that you cross some sort of, you know, Rubicon when 26 and 7-year-olds are gunned down in their classroom, a safe space, along with 6 of their teachers and educators. You'd have thought that that was a moment when we might have reassessed our approach to mental illness, to parenting, to guns, to the kinds of guns that we have and the way we treat them.
We're talking to Professor Rob Cox, the 2017 James H. Ottaway Sr. Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. Well, you know, here in New York, let me say that Governor Cuomo decided right after this, and clearly it was what made it happen, that this was going to redefine gun violence in the United States, and passed his act, so-called SAFE Act, which has garnered him the undying enmity of a lot of people, particularly in upstate New York. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I mean, it is quite interesting. You see the SAFE Act signs, or the sort of stop safe, or the safe with a cross through it. And certainly you see it also in Connecticut. I mean, look, there is almost certainly a rural-urban divide on this issue. It's no question. Rural on one side, and then I would say urban and suburban divide, actually, because as the metropolitan centers become bigger, more expansive, you see that attitudes towards guns shift more towards the idea of greater regulation rather than less regulation. But in rural districts, it has become somewhat of a rallying cry for, you know, independence in a sense from the metropolitan elite, if you will. And there's no question that guns And I grew up with, I have shotguns, I'm a hunter. I completely sympathize with that. The issue is really, at the end of the day, Governor Cuomo, just as Governor Malloy did and other governors around the country, essentially just managed to tighten up some of the restrictions that are meant to really keep guns out of the hands of those who seriously shouldn't have them. And I think if you look at the statistics in those states where they have done these things, Connecticut versus Missouri, where they loosen the laws, you see that this ultimately has an impact on public health, a beneficial impact on public health. And look, that's how people lead. That's how leaders lead. They have to make decisions that at least 51% of their constituents believe in. That doesn't mean the 49% are wrong, and they should always make their case. But that's how democracy works.
Rob Cox, you joined the NRA. That was a journalistic pursuit, was it not?
It was a combination. I mean, again, I've been a gun owner, still am a gun owner. I own shotguns, and I have long been a fan of hunting and birds, wild boar. I actually wrote about going hunting in the Loire Valley of France and in the near Okeechobee in Florida for wild boar. I kind of had this obsession with hunting wild boar for some time, and so I pursued that. I had spent some time with up in the Catskills shooting birds every Columbus Day weekend with a number of folks, and these are, you know, gun owners, very staunch Second Amendment believers and gun rights activists, including a guy who worked for a major gun manufacturer in Connecticut, libertarians, very few who were, I would call, liberal, of course. But, you know, these are folks who feel very strongly in the rights endowed by the Second Amendment. We had a lot of spirited, interesting debates. And they were long, you know, told me, look, the NRA is a bunch of jerks. Those guys are just lobbyists shilling for an industry. They don't really, like, long term, they may actually be doing damage to those who believe in the Second Amendment by, you know, extending it way too far to the point of, you know, every assault rifle or AR-15, you know, should be in the hands of non-competent people. That is bad, but it's good in the short term because it sells guns. There are a lot of folks who are good folks who are gun owners, hunters, who do not like the NRA, and I think that's fair. I just thought it does offer some amazing things if you are a member. I mean, there's lots of freebies, all that kind of stuff, which is interesting. I really wanted to understand how they reach out to their followers, how they get them to be so spirited and have so much intensity towards their cause, because that is one of the things you see from the gun rights side, incredible intensity. If you look even in the NRA's tax filings, because they're a public, you know, a 501c3, you can pick those up and read them. They point out that they have 150,000. It's probably higher, but that's the number they use of, you know, active supporters. Now that group is, you know, they're the folks who show up armed and looking pretty dangerous at rallies. And I think that scares the bejesus out of politicians. But they do have a lot more intensity than the other side, which is, you know, Moms Demand Action or Everytown or some of these gun safety groups who really have struggled to get that level of intensity. So I really wanted to see what kind of messaging I would receive as a member of the NRA. I also want to see what kind of goodies they'd give me. So a free, you know, like a wine club and discounted trips, shoot elk in Ethiopia and whatever it might be. Yeah, fantastic service and a fantastic messaging. I don't agree with the message. The message is one of dire fear. It's almost a perfect reflection of Donald Trump's inaugural speech, which I suppose will go down as the quote unquote American carnage speech, which kind of, it drives home the idea that everything's falling apart. Law and order is falling apart. You kind of might need to defend yourself, aka buy yourself guns. Things are going to hell in a handbasket. Oh no, it's all terrible. And that fear is what has driven gun sales over the past, let's say, 8.5 years during the Obama administration. A combination of lawlessness and law and order crumbling, not least because of what we saw with the financial crisis, and the notion that each time we have these mass shootings, that your gun rights will be taken away. That sort of double fear is what's driven gun sales, and it is what the NRA has perpetrated. And that was fascinating to watch. I did also go down to one of their conventions and interview some folks. You know, normal. I went, though, really more, I would say I went more as a member than I went as a journalist. I did, though, write a very long piece for BuzzFeed about what it was like to be a member of the NRA, and I I don't think it was as critical. A lot of people said, oh, you know, you did this. You praise the NRA. You talk about what a fantastic service they provide, how great. And I said, yeah, I do, because I think it's important for those who want to take on the NRA to recognize that they are very simply the representative of an industry that for all sorts of reasons has gotten away with extraordinary feats of deregulation. I mean, the gun industry is the only industry in this country that enjoys protections from consumer product liability lawsuits. There is no other industry, not lawn darts. Look around right now, wherever you are, if you're in a car, if you're at home, pretty much everything around you is not protected in the way that guns are from consumer product liability. So it was fascinating to read that, to understand that, and to try to transmit that to people, really in the service of those who, if you really think the NRA is a bad guy, then you really need to understand them a bit better. And that's really what I tried to do.
Well, the question then becomes, who would want to shoot a bird?
If you want to eat a bird, then you need to shoot it.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. But I take it if you're out in the woods and they're shooting birds, that's a mindset that I'm having trouble with. Could you explain it to me? I mean, if you're not eating sparrows, you're not eating cardinals, songbirds.
Well, I would never defend the practice of shooting songbirds, for sure. But look, I don't have a problem with hunting. I mean, this is, again, it's a moralistic judgment one makes. I eat meat, so I should very well be prepared to kill for that meat, I suppose, in theory, right? And so I have, on occasion, gone out and shot, as I said, wild boar, and, you know, used everything that we could out of those two beasts. And in fact, I actually served a massive dinner for people after shooting wild boar in Florida. And so, I mean, again, you may have that problem with hunting. I don't personally view hunting as quite the same thing as our, and there are rules around hunting, let's be really clear. Like, you have to get a tag for various things. As you know, every state's a bit different. You need to get training. You need to know what you're doing. There are some things you can do, some things you can't do. We prescribe rules to these things. That is, I guess, and when I look at, take it to a step further to gun regulation, it's the same thing. What rules do we actually prescribe? And ultimately, should those rules be uniform around the country? And that's really what the debate on gun regulation has been.
So interesting. Rob, if you could, why don't you tell us a little bit about, because you have a financial side and you're teaching this seminar on basically finance and journalism, if I understand it correctly, what is it that you want your students to know about the evolving media market?
Well, it's twofold. So my class is called Financial Journalism and the Business of Media. So it's sort of twofold, right? I want to teach, help these. It's really an introduction because they have not done any form of financial journalism at all as part of their coursework. So I want to introduce them to some basic understanding of financial journalism. That is, so, you know, how do you read an income statement? You start at the top with revenue, you get to the bottom, the net income, and in between is the story. And so we're trying to, I'm not teaching a business school class or an accounting class, but we are trying to understand that. So I've had them work on an earnings story, you know, how to understand a company's trends based on the earnings statement. But we're applying this to media companies, the companies that support journalism, because the kids in the class, for the most part, are going to go out and try to get a job as journalists. So you need to understand, like never before, certainly when I graduated from Columbia Journalism School in 1992, the world was our oyster. Okay, it might have been a cyclical downturn at the time, but you could go to papers, you could go to broadcast, you could go wherever, and it was all growing, right? And that is just so obviously not the case in this day and age. Newspapers are shrinking. Magazines are going away. Websites are going up, but a lot of them are still not making money. Television is imperiled in many respects, too, because advertising is shifting online. So I think it's important for the kids and for anyone in our industry to understand the business that supports the work we do. That doesn't mean I'm saying, oh, you have to, you know, prostitute your journalism for the sake of business. Not at all. Of course, it's sacrosanct that you don't do that. But it's rather important that you understand, okay, what are the drivers of our business and how will they allow us to do great journalism? It's extraordinary how little we cared about that 10, 15 years ago. But as you see today, you know, with layoffs across the spectrum of the media business, it is rather important. So it's a sort of twofold class. So we did the earnings story, like I suggested. We looked at the New York Times fourth quarter numbers, and I had everybody write about, you know, their take on that. And then I gave them another company, a newspaper company's results, and said, go write about that. And that was fascinating because the kids were grappling with the idea, okay, on the one hand, you'll see that the, like, every single company says, oh, our digital subscriptions and advertising is up 10%, 12%, whatever. But when you actually look at the numbers, the print advertising is down, you know, a quantum greater in absolute terms than that suggests. And so they need to understand that. We looked at things like the Snapchat. We're looking at Snap and sort of the social media companies. And I had them look at the IPO, you know, for every company that goes public, they have to issue what's called a prospectus, officially an S-1 from the Securities and Exchange Commission. It is a massive document that is circulated to any prospective investor that basically lays bare anything that can go wrong with this company. It's the one time a company really does open its kimono, to use that hackneyed phrase. And so I had them look at Snap and the IPO, and they all understand Snap because these are, remember, they're 20, 21-year-old kids. They know how to use it, unlike people like me who can't for the life
or
of
me.
Work out.
Yeah.
It's impossible, you know, and so they worked through it. And that was really fascinating because I gave them all, they got into working groups, looked at the prospectus, and then I sort of gave them some pointers, but each of them came back with really interesting risk factors, you know, like around the company that were really the main ones that drove the coverage of and probably still drive the valuation and the stock price. So it was a first for them to go through that prospectus. Now I have them looking at mergers and acquisitions in the industry because I think, you know, as you see things like AT&T buying Time Warner, and which includes CNN, and, you know, there's lots of consolidation in the industry. So to understand, that's a way to understand the M&A story, but also to understand how it affects the businesses that they might one day work for. My hope, of course, from all this is one of the kids, if not all of them, comes out and says, you know, the hell with it, I'm going to go and start my, you know, this is an extraordinary moment where you actually can start businesses where there's capital that people are willing to risk, and you have so much disruption that maybe one of these guys comes up with the solution to the problem and creates the next great website, or even just one that's profitable would be fine. So I think it's quite interesting. And it's also interesting for me to look at my own industry through that prism as a professor, something I've never done before, and to try to see it through their eyes.
We're talking to Rob Cox, the 2017 James H. Ottaway Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. So, Rob, I guess Warren Buffett raised my eyebrows the other day because he said there were only two newspapers in the country that were assured of staying alive, if I'm not misquoting him, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and maybe, just maybe, the Washington Post. What do you make of that prediction?
I love Warren Buffett. Let me preface it that way. He is fantastic. Every year I read his letter to shareholders, and it's just always filled with wisdom and the wisdom of experience. I would say he's right on two points, which is from a national perspective, there are only going to be a couple of newspapers. And I think the word, you should get rid of paper, because in 10 years, I'm not sure they'll be on paper. I mean, I don't see why they would be, but they will be national brands that cover everything and cover it with distinction. And that's clearly going to be the New York Times. And I think he's right about the Wall Street Journal. And I think the Washington Post under Jeff Bezos, the Amazon boss and share founder who has sort of endless amounts of money, he's done an amazing job with the Washington Post. And made it much more of a read. He's using Amazon Prime to drive subscriptions across the country. I think that is also going to be a newspaper, like part of the national conversation. I don't think that there'll be newspapers anymore. And I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing. We will read all these things digitally. But I think that's fine as far as, like, they will be the papers that guide the national debate. I still think you are going to need local newspapers to cover local events. And I hope and actually believe they'll probably be in a position to do a better job if they give up in some respects. I don't know whether it is covering the State House and just say you have a collective and we take the AP or whoever it is or Reuters on those stories. And we just focus on, you know, the local community board issues, the community battles. I mean, every community has fights, you know, between people who want something and people who don't want something, or local corruption. I think it's extremely important. You know, the problem is those models make sense. People want that information. That information is instrumental to democracy. It's just working out the economics is definitely difficult. But, you know, for the local auto dealer that wants to advertise to people who want to come to the showroom, take a test drive, the local movie theater that wants to drive people into the seats. They are always going to need places where people congregate online and locally. So I feel like there'll still be a strong community journalism. It just won't be quite the daily paper as it won't be the national daily paper in, 10 plus years.
Well, I'm interested in a number of ways to go with you, but I guess the one thing that a lot of people are talking about these days is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has described the media as an enemy of the people. I read it back in the day, and it's a terrible term. And he is trying to enemyize, the media. They have to be one of his traditional enemies. What do you make of that?
I've been thinking I need to get a T-shirt or a hat that says enemy of the people and wear it with some pride, not because I am in any way an enemy of the people. Anyone who knows the founding documents of our democracy or who reads Thomas Jefferson knows that the founders believed very strongly that a robust and free press is critical to maintaining the democracy for the people. So I think it's not helpful for Donald Trump or to anyone to castigate the media in this way. It is essential for free press. I've been around the world. I've covered. This is how despots speak. This is how people in, Kyrgyzstan view a free press, or Turkey, or Philippines. This is not how a robust democracy views the media. However, I would say this. I feel like the media has seen this as a real rallying cry to do its job with extraordinary precision and accuracy, and fundamentally examine how we do what we do. Make sure that we are not biased. We can be as critical as we like, as criticism has nothing to do with bias. If you think Donald Trump is abusing office, if you think Michael Flynn lied, if you think Stephen Bannon is spinning racism, then you need to call that out, because those are fundamentally against the values enshrined in our Constitution. And so what I find interesting, and in fact, I bought for all my staff, handed them out a copy of the Constitution. I've got one, and it's a well-worn one. I feel like a lot of my liberal friends are now just discovering some of the values enshrined in that document, whether it's the 10th Amendment on states' rights, the First Amendment, whatever it might be. And I think that's a generally good thing. And I'm not just talking about people in the media at all. In fact, I'm just talking about everybody. People really are examining the Constitution in ways that they didn't before. And I think that's a good thing, because, I don't view it in some religious, maybe I do view it somewhat religiously. I mean, the values enshrined there are fundamental and have served this country extremely well. And they're also the envy of the rest of the world. It is very problematic when the President of the United States, who is meant to enshrine, embody, and defend, it is actually in the oath of office, that Constitution, the values of that Constitution, decides that you can go around sort of disparaging the press in this way. It's bad, because it means your moral authority and the rest of the world is diminished. And by the way, it absolutely has been. You cannot look to the United States at the moment and its leadership and take a lot of comfort. In fact, if you are a despot, you probably look at it and use it as, aha, those guys who've been preaching to us for a long time about the values of democracy, look at them now. Which was the same problem in the financial crisis, when we all of a sudden decided to intervene, even though we'd been this bastion of free market capitalism. So I think that's the real tragedy for it. It basically allows, in some ways, it's a wink and a nod towards people like Duterte, the Philippines president, who has, where just this week a journalist, a columnist was killed, and where extrajudicial killings are happening on a daily basis. That's the problem. It erodes America's soft power.
Do you think Trump is a fascist?
I don't want to use a label. I'd say that what Trump is doing is not embodying the principles enshrined in the Constitution. I don't feel that he is fulfilling the oath of office in that respect. And there are any number of ways. The lack of transparency, certainly castigating all institutions, is a very dangerous thing to do. So going after, the intelligence community, going after the FBI, going after the judicial branch, as he has done, going after
the electoral process,
going after the Congressional Budget Office, because you don't like the numbers they came out with on scoring the House's health plan, going after the Bureau of Labor Statistics, because you don't believe, for no good reason. You just don't believe that the numbers, that the job numbers under Obama were real until, of course, you have your first month of good numbers, and now all of a sudden you believe in the BLS. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which puts out those numbers. So what you see is this constant strategy of breaking down the credibility of the institutions of democracy. That's dangerous. Is that fascism? I don't know. I'm sure that fascist leaders in the past employed very similar tactics.
That's so fascinating. So are the students up to it that you've been talking to?
Yeah.
Look, I taught at New Paltz for 40 years, and I had a sense that unlike private institutions or so-called independent institutions, the kids at New Paltz, often who were the first ones to go to college in their families, were incredibly motivated by getting a job as opposed to only intellectual exploration. Getting a job became important. Is that something you find?
You look, I mean, it is. I think my students are really smart, and they're very motivated. And as you say, maybe some are first generation in college, and many are paying for it themselves or taking on debt to do so. So I think they could be very motivated, and that's a good thing, that they may not have the luxury of saying, well, I'll just spend 4 years studying Nietzsche and Kant and getting my philosophy major and then decide what I'm going to do, because they have financial exigencies that force them to think about a job. And so I think that's fine. For the most part, they're all extremely engaged. We have conversations in class. Remember, this is a subject matter they, in most cases, have never come across before. They've maybe never looked at an earnings statement or a balance sheet. And a lot of them, when we started, they were very trepidatious, and they sort of warned me that, well, you know, I don't really know math. I don't really like math and that kind of thing. And so, this is not a math class, but it is following the logic of arithmetic as anything is when you read an income statement or balance sheet. You do need to do, you know, subtraction and addition. So I think they're all pretty psyched to get out and practice this fantastic profession that they've been studying. So, I think it's going to be tough. There's no question. There's tons of competition out there. There aren't a ton of jobs. That's why I say it's really important, I feel, that they understand what they're getting into, that they understand the fundamentals of the business of journalism are really challenged and face increasing headwinds. They aren't going away. So, you know, they may have to think about more non-traditional paths towards careers, whether it's starting their own business, just striking out on their own as a freelance person, finding the place where they really can add value as a freelancer or as a writer, thinking they're just going to have to think differently than sort of writing in 40 applications for internships at the Wall Street Journal and the Los Angeles Times, because there are just not enough of those jobs. And there are people who have already gotten graduate degrees in journalism or have some experience that are going to be standing ahead of them in the queue. But, I'm impressed with what I've seen. And I think part of that is, Alan, I think it is a reflection of, you know, perhaps some of them are facing more difficult economic circumstances than they might be if they were a bunch of rich kids, say, at a liberal arts college. And so that guides them and motivates them in ways that I find refreshing.
Professor Rob Cox, Ottawa professor. So I use the word professor. It may make you a little uncomfortable. Very few people in all my career ended up saying professor to me. Nevertheless, I always loved it when they did. And now you're on the academic side. You have to, maybe you don't have to because you're in a special place. But I had to go to faculty meetings, which I hated. I had to rise in judgment over whether people got tenure or didn't for all those years that I was there. And I saw some pretty petty stuff that was really kind of crazy. I'm wondering whether you have an honest analysis of the academic profession.
Well, look, it's a fellowship, so I come in, I swoop in on Thursdays, I teach a three-hour seminar, and I spend a lot of time preparing for that, weekends mainly, just trying to think it through. And so it's like a second job for sure. But I have not, you know, I don't get involved in any of the politics of academia or the issues surrounding, benefits and all that kind of stuff. I just don't have an insight into that. And it's not something I feel like, you know, in my short time here at SUNY New Paltz, it would be good use of my time. But I certainly see, you know, look, I've been in the private sector all my life, and I started a business. So I had a startup for a few, 9 years that I built and then eventually sold to a giant company, Thomson Reuters. Now I'm there. You know, there obviously things are done differently. And, you know, I'm not saying one is more efficient than the other, but certainly the pressures inside of a publicly traded company that must hit its numbers and has to give guidance to its shareholders and things like that is going to be different necessarily than a public university that has different pressures than those. But in the end, they're all the same. You know, people are going to grumble. I'm sure my colleagues, you know, I have 36 employees, journalists based in New York, London, Washington, Hong Kong, Dallas, Beijing, Mumbai, Frankfurt, Madrid, and Milan. So all the, they all, I'm sure, grumble like crazy about me or about Thomson Reuters. And certainly in a place like Reuters, there's lots of palace intrigue about, you know, our leadership, about the company's future, those kinds of things. I generally, though, my advice has always been to understand it, but don't sweat too much about it. Don't spend too much time dealing with things you're not going to be able to change. And that's still sort of my take on, even though, of course, my class is studying the big picture and I'm encouraging them to understand the companies that they might one day want to work for, emulate, or compete against, you need to understand them. But that doesn't mean spending all your time obsessing about things you can't change.
Rob Cox, I have a theory about the New York Times. I want to lay it on you and see what you think.
Sure.
I think the New York Times has been incredibly courageous in the whole exploration of Trump and what he represents in the United States. And I think in order to do that, they have gone further out on a journalistic ledge than I've ever seen before from them. In other words, I really think that they took some real chances and they told it as they thought it was, but that it was different from the kind of journalism that had been practiced in the United States up to now. In other words, I thought they may be biased, but they were correctly biased in terms of the danger of what the country was facing. You think I'm wrong?
Well, I think the New York Times is doing an admirable job in light of a couple of different pressures that it's facing. One is financial. You know, the New York Times is still struggling with the decline in print advertising that's just not going to let up until the print is dead. And a digital business, a subscription business, and digital advertising business that does not produce the kinds of dollars that support the kind of journalism that it currently now believes in. So I think it's going to have to figure out how to do what it's doing or more with less. And that means, you know, making decisions about what it covers and how it covers that. And I think you see that in different parts of the paper. They have decided that the election of Donald Trump offers a unique moment in history in which they will be impactful and can help the course of democracy. And at the same time, it's a good business decision.
Yes, but in doing what you just said, have they strayed from traditional journalistic ethics?
I don't see any evidence that their ethics are compromised at all, frankly. I mean, you know, it's easy to accuse them of bias for going after Donald Trump, but I think there are legitimate reasons to go after a businessman who, with an opaque business, I mean, this is not like a public company, the Trump Organization, where you can see what kinds of business it does. He hasn't produced his tax returns. He has legitimately and purposely obfuscated the American people. So I think it's completely legitimate. Do I agree the editorial? Do I think the editorial page can become across as too one-sided? Perhaps, but that's why I also read the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, which is equally one-sided in its perspective. I put them together, and I feel like I have the perfect sandwich in understanding and then forging my own views on things. I don't feel like the New York Times has been compromised. I do think, you know, look, certain things, you look at the pages like the style section or whatever, and certain areas like that, they're obviously kind of fluffy. They don't always, but, you know, I don't have to read them. Like, I don't read Vogue. I probably should, given my sartorial weaknesses. But I, you know, I just find, you know, so when I read the front page and I look at pieces done by incredible reporters like Eric Lipton, who I worked with, he was my mentor, as it were. He was my editor at the Vermont Cynic at the University of Vermont when I was starting out as a staff writer. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. He continues to pull the cover off of stories that reveal this unholy alliance between money and politics and the decisions that policymakers make based on what looks to be a trail of influence in money. And I think that's You know, that's really an incredibly important issue for our democracy. So, I see stories like that. They don't, having known the guy, I know he is not biased. I don't know how he votes. I just know that he knows a great story when he sees one. And a great story is when people try to obfuscate the truth from the American people. Again, I think the business is challenged. The New York Times is not out of the woods. But I do think that they have not compromised their journalism as a result of that.
So do you think that there is, this is something I fight with my colleagues on the Media Project all the time. Do you think there is a bleed from the editorial page, which I couldn't agree with you more, they say what they think. But do you think there's a bleed into the news columns?
I don't know. I mean, look, I think that, you know, it is a paper staffed like the Wall Street Journal, really, or the Washington Post, or probably Reuters and Bloomberg and others. We are staffed by largely metropolitan people, people who live in big cities or the suburbs of large cities, just how it works. And our views are going to reflect the values of those places. And those values largely err on the side of things like globalization, urbanization, digitalization. And if you look at those trends, those are often antithetical to some of the values that you might find in rural America. Like we talked about the gun issue, for instance. You know, as people suburbanize, they become less interested and less comfortable with guns in homes. Period. They'll not only in their own homes, but in the homes of their neighbors. And gun ownership declines as you go into urban areas and suburban areas. So there'll be some issues around that. And of course that may be reflected by the people who work at the New York Times, but so is their readership. That's their readership too. So I just don't see it bleeding so much. I think it's just a reflection of the ethos of their readership and of the people who work there.
Okay, so then the question would be, when the Times hires, do they hire in their own image? In other words, and the Wall Street Journal too. In other words, is it clear that we are hiring somebody who is a Timesman as opposed to, you know, somebody who might have a more conservative viewpoint in the world?
Well, look, I don't speak for the New York Times, just to be clear, you know, and I've worked with them for years.
Of course
we had
not.
A newspaper, you know, Breaking Views had a column in the New York Times for about 5 years in the business section. So I know lots of people there, and I know I think I have an understanding of the culture as much as one can have as an outsider. But I would say this about generally in the media, there is a huge desire to hire diversity. It is part of our policy. So I'm looking at somebody for a position in Hong Kong. I'm looking at someone for a position in New York. It is now so firmly part of the process internally that I must look at diverse candidates. And that means candidates, and I can define that can be race. It can be ethnic background, which is slightly different than race. It's certainly gender. I mean, I am under a lot of pressure to, not just pressure, I'm under my own ambition to have a more diverse community of people from which to draw our views. And that means having more women on staff than the 40% or so that we have now. It means having, you know, maybe a veteran on board, because I've never fought in battle. I've never been in the armed forces. I do have two veterans now on my staff. It means hiring people who might have come from different socioeconomic backgrounds that might not have been privileged to go to a fine school and do okay and then get out and continue to do okay, as often is the case for those who are born on the right side of history or whatever it is. So I'm always looking for diversity in that respect. And I believe very strongly that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all of our other sort of colleagues and competitors are under the same, you know, feel the same way about hiring. And by the way, that it's not necessarily I don't hire based on politics. If I did, that would be basically saying that we are biased, and I don't believe we are. So if I said, oh, well, now we have to hire a conservative person, that's like, oh, why? Because we all believe we're liberal. If I believe we're all liberal, then we failed at the outset. I think what we are is objective, discerning, critical, and analytical. And that's to me the most important thing. And, you know, in fact, I'd throw it back and say, I wonder if Breitbart and all these other sort of conservative, you know, aspiring outlets, which are, you know, they're blatantly biased. They're blatantly cheering for one side. And I think they lack complete diversity.
Rob Cox, Ottawa professor, let me change subjects and ask you about something I know you lecture about and that you've written about. Your father's electric knife.
Yeah, it's actually my grandfather's electric knife. So I will be doing I have to do a talk, and I'll tell everybody about the electric carving knife that I found in my grandfather's basement maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And it was still in the box. And it was, it was one of those two serrated edge knives.
Indeed.
That you, yep. Side by side, they kind of go back and forth. Anyway, I was fascinated by it. I found this thing, and it was still in the box, and the box said that it had been made in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is a city very close to where I grew up in Newtown. And it got me thinking, that's interesting. So they made these things in, just down the road from me. We're having these conversations and this grand debate about manufacturing in this country and the loss of good jobs and a sort of making America great again is all about sort of going back to that era. And I just thought it would be interesting to explore that a bit. And so I did a bit of work on it and tried to find out where that knife had come from, how it had been manufactured, and when it had been invented. And it was pretty surprising to me. And it was really easy. I could see how one could be lured into this, this nostalgia for an era gone by. So shall I tell you? So it was.
Yes.
There was a plant. Yeah. So in Bridgeport, there was the Bridgeport Works. General Electric's Bridgeport Works, and they had manufactured small appliances there, toasters, heating, fans, all that kind of stuff for decades. It started actually, though, well, before I go back to where it started, so at its height, it had this gigantic factory. I think it was 13 giant block buildings. You can still see it if you look on Google Earth. There are two pictures I can find. One that has the building still there. They tore it down brick for brick about 7 years ago. And one without the building, and it still looks like one of these giant, just this huge empty space in the middle of the city of Bridgeport. But General Electric, at its height, had about 20,000 people employed in this plant, in this factory. Not just making appliances, they had all sorts of other things they did there. Wiring and, all sorts of high tech for its era. They had a bowling alley. They had a bar. They had their own daily newspaper, or not daily newspaper, fortnightly newspaper, which they would produce for staff. And I've gone through and looked at this. So I've gone up to the General Electric's archives some of them are housed at the Museum of Science and Industry in Schenectady, New York, which is where General Electric used to be headquartered. In fact, Thomas Edison moved the headquarters from New York City to Schenectady, a century ago. And so going through these fortnightly papers, the paper that was produced for the staff, it is fascinating. You really do go back into an era that I think is what Make America Great Again is sort of pretending or trying to get at, which is, this community, this family, almost paternalistic, even though there were, of course, labor relations, sometimes rocky between the workers and General Electric management. But, you had bowling leagues, so you could see like GE playing, Dictaphone or some other now extinct company based in Stratford or Bridgeport or something. You'd see stories about the guy who worked on the line in the toaster division who managed to be on What's My Line or some show, in the 50s or 60s, or how I think it was 65. I was looking at one of the papers where they talked about this fantastic success that GE had sponsoring a television program. It was one of the first Christmas programs. It was the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, one with the abominable snow monster. And the kid who wants to be the elf who wants to be a dentist. I mean, fantastic. I grew up with this thing. Who knew that it was basically sponsored by this plant, GE at the time, to sell products that were produced in this plant. Now, all those jobs are gone. The plant has been, torn down brick by brick. And you can get nostalgic about this and say, gosh, if only those jobs were back. But then I did some analysis and you look at the cost of that knife today. So if I were to take in today's dollars, the amount my grandfather paid for that knife, it was basically something like for $15.99 today, you can buy the same thing that my grandfather paid, whatever it was 50 years ago for $19.99, right? So it's $4 cheaper in absolute terms. But if you adjust that for inflation, he paid around $120 in today's terms, enough to buy seven equivalent knives today. That, in a nutshell, is sort of the quantified benefit of whether you call it globalization of supply chains, automation of manufacturing. And then I went through the Sears Roebuck catalog from around 1969, 1970, and did the same exercise. And what you see is the standard of living in America has gone up because, in part, we have actually globalized our workforce, our supply chains, and those benefits are massive, and they are shared across the board, but they don't have stories to tell. So the fact that you pay $15 rather than $120 for your knife, okay, great. Would you sacrifice workers for that? Well, no, maybe not, because that worker has a story to tell. They have a family to support. They have health care to pay for, all of those things. So it's very, and those people have voices, and they were given a voice during the election campaign, even though if you really were to do this mathematically, look across the fact that 70% of the American economy is consumption, and the benefits of this global economy have accrued to everyone across the board in ways that are far greater than the loss of, the, let's say, even a million manufacturing jobs over the past 20 years, which may or may not be the case based on the, you know, since China entered the World Trade Organization. So I just think the point of this is we need to understand, we can't just deal in sound bites here. We have to understand the benefits that have accrued globally and across this country to all consumers. And what happens if you were to take those away? It would really hit those people who, you know, frankly, buy cheaper goods at Walmart, and for a larger percentage of their paycheck, they will be really hurt if you were to end the sort of global trade supply chain that we have at the moment, and which Donald Trump advocated for.
Is it your sense that Trump, who has invested overseas, understands that, but it's just throwing red meat to his potential voters?
I think Donald Trump understood how to get elected, and that was by, you know, creating these you know, sort of almost false arguments and debates and crises. He seems to be doing that with sort of in regular fashion as well as the president of the United States. So I don't fault him. He won. And even if it was only, let's say, 90,000 workers or blue-collar folks who would have voted normally Democrat in, you know, three states like Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, you can say that, but he did win, and he did win the Electoral College, and so he was effective in that respect. I don't know. I don't get a sense that he has an ideology. Look, it is a man who's had his ties and all of his Trump-branded goods manufactured, and Ivanka, her branded goods in Indonesia, Vietnam, China, take your pick. So I don't think there's an ideology there. However, he has hired people with strong ideologies that I think are economically irrational in many cases to high positions in his cabinet. And the worry that one has for a man who is so ideologically disinclined is that he is an empty vessel. And an empty vessel can be scarier than an ideologue whose views you can refute.
Except that, Rob Cox, it seems to me that there is a question of morality here. It's not only that you can say, okay, you're a success because you became the president, but at what cost? What are you doing? You've mentioned it yourself to American institutions and philosophy and the Constitution. So it's not that easy to just simply say, okay, you're here, but you as a financial analyst and somebody who really understands this stuff, I mean, he's been going after China from the very beginning. Does that portend a war with China?
You know, I hope not. China is, here's a fact everyone in America and everywhere in Europe needs to understand. China will be, you know, 3 billion people in 20-something years, right? It is going to be the largest economy in the world. It is going to be the dominant economic power on the globe. Get over it. That's just going to happen, whatever we do. You can try to fight it in some rearguard action, like Steve Bannon or Donald Trump might be conjuring up. More likely, you need to figure out how you benefit as well from the growth of China and the normalization of China in the world economy. And I don't think, though, in the past, I mean, China is not an imperialistic nation. It is one that its leaders are constantly trying to figure out how to keep the place from boiling over. That is the Chinese history. It was always thus under the different dynasties. It is a place that has a revolution every whatever generation. And so the Chinese Communist Party is more focused on keeping things harmonious at home. Now, foreign policy relates to that. The way you're perceived abroad is important. I mean, I think when you look at Xi Jinping's speech, the president of China's speech at Davos at the World Economic Forum this year, people talked about how, you know, he sort of embraced globalism. He was sounded like the Donald Trump, you know, the opposite of Donald Trump, the sort of Tony Blair, Bill Clinton wing of global policy. And everyone took that as, look, he's trying to jump in and take the place of Donald Trump or the American presidency now that it no longer is focused on globalization and leadership. Well, actually, it had nothing to do with that. It was all about keeping it at home so that when Donald Trump slaps tariffs on China, he can say, look, we tried. We wanted to be honest brokers for globalization. It was all about internal consumption. And I think really that's the focus for China. There are going to be flare-ups in the South China Sea and China with its neighbors. But I think all of these, if cooler heads, you know, prevail, people will understand that China is a force. It's ultimately going to be the economic power in the world, and learning to live with it, to benefit from that, to work together harmoniously is ultimately going to be in all of our interests. So I would hope that that is the view that prevails rather than some sort of rear guard notion that we can stop China's rise, which seems to be, you know, part of the wing of the Steve Bannon wing of the Republican Party.
We're out of time. We've been talking to financial journalist Rob Cox, this year's James H. Ottaway Sr. Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. If you'd like to see Professor Cox, he'll deliver a public speech at SUNY New Paltz on Tuesday, April 4th at 7 p.m. in the Quaker-Dall Science Building Auditorium. He'll talk about globalization through the story of his grandfather's electric carving knife. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. I love your program. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thanks, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.